So I guess that the idea was to talk about open quantum systems here. Hi, Nor.
How's it going? Good to see you.
Talk about open quantum systems here, in the particular, since Derek is leaving on Monday. This was sort of the last opportunity, I think, and we decided that we want to split 1 hour between the two of us. So we've been interested for a while in what's called chiral quantum optics, and I would like to explain afterwards what I mean by this. And I sort of find it interesting because it's an interesting quantum many-body system, and I've sort of added one slide over here at the beginning why I find this kind of interesting. So when you think of a standard situation that we have in quantum optics, where we have an atom that talks to another one by photon exchange, so it's sort of, that one goes down and of course a photon comes out and the other one goes up, but then you also, there will always be a symmetric process like this. Then of course what all of us immediately do is this, to write down very happily, this dipole-dipole interaction of this type. And the way how we obtain it is of course that we integrate out photons as degrees of freedom. But at the end of the day, we write down a Hamiltonian essentially for the atoms alone. What we mean by this chiral quantum optics is now a situation where you only go one way. So this means that an atom over here emitting a photon can only emit it in one direction. So this means that it can sort of being absorbed by an atom over here. But if this atom decides to emit a photon, think of a 1D geometry at the moment, and we have a broken left-right symmetry. And so at this point, you might be sort of tempted to write down Hamiltonian of this type. But maybe then some of you remember from quantum mechanics that Hamiltonians are supposed to be Hermitian. And so there's a question. And of course, the answer at the end will be that it is really, we assume here that this is an infinite system. So if you put a mirror over here and you make it finite, eventually this photon comes back and of course everything will be okay as before. So the infinity of the system, that this is an open quantum system, is somehow important for all of these things. So the question is, do these kind of things occur in nature? And the answer is yes, with these nanophotonic systems. And then the second question is, do these kind of things lead to interesting sort of new many-body physics? And at least we have some examples where maybe the answer is also, I guess, yes. So this is what we mean by chiral interactions in these quantum many-body systems. And so the first thing, of course, that comes to your mind when you see this word chiral quantum optics is that you have something like this. So this is a spin and this is a spin, and think maybe of the edge mode that you have in 2D topology. Of course, there's an infinity of number of papers out there. Here you got the chiral edge channel, so it would correspond to a situation that if I take this system going to infinity, that I would have here a situation that this only docks to that. And of course, here you can see if it's finite, of course, these things always eventually come back. But this is actually not what we have in mind. Under the name chiral quantum optics, and we actually put the paper as a Nature review that might even go through, hopefully. No? On the archive some time ago, together with Peter Lodahl, who is in Copenhagen. He's a quantum dot experimentalist, and of course with Arno Rauschenbeutel, who for us has provided a lot of motivation for what we did on the theory side. If you do nanophotonics, you get something like this almost for free, but it comes in a different way. Namely, the important point is this, that there's what's called chiral coupling between light and quantum emitters. So it's not the chiral channel, that you only have modes propagating one way, but you got the chiral coupling. And the experimental situation is probably best summarized in this picture over here, which is taken from this paper by a science paper from Arno Rauschenbeutel a few years ago. I'm not going to explain the physics, but sort of effectively simply say what it means. So what Arno does in his experiments is that he has a nanofiber and is able to trap atoms up here. And these atoms are able to emit photon, and due to essentially spin orbit coupling of light. You can see that this is sort of mentioned up here in the direction. What it means, and I don't have time to explain now where these things are actually coming from, it means a situation where if this atom over here, and there's a lot to be said, what conditions and so on, if this atom over here emits a photon, with a very high probability, I think in the experiment it's more than 95% or so, it goes into one direction, and this one also goes in one direction. So this is an example of one of these very asymmetric systems where the spontaneous emission rate into the left and right propagating modes is very different. And so this chirality actually turns out, this left-right asymmetry, this broken left-right symmetry, is sort of related here to spin-orbit coupling. And it appears naturally in all of these nanophotonic structures here. So it's not something that you have to engineer and sort of buy. It's something that appears actually naturally. So as I said, I'm not going to explain now where these things come from, but let's simply take this kind of a setup here as a model where we, in the context of quantum optics, can now think what it means when these atoms now start to talk to each other. And you can see that this one can talk to this one, this one can talk to this one. So the atoms sort of talk downstream. In the extreme case, that this gamma L is equal to zero, the spontaneous emission rate. So this would be what we call a cascading quantum system. And when we have broken left-right symmetry, then we call it chiral. And so it's essentially what I had before on my slide. So this is chiral quantum optics. And here's sort of a few cartoons that kind of point out how we want to describe it and what these things mean. So chiral quantum optics means the following, that we sort of say it again in this Rauschenbeutel setup that we have here. You know, a photon is emitted left-right with this symmetry. And I emphasize that I want an open boundary here. If you put here a mirror, this photon will be reflected, and that's not what I want. And I want this broken left-right symmetry. So the extreme case is the one, what we call at the end, in the cascading quantum system, where these things go unidirectional. This is almost what they have in the experiment, where it goes down, then it only goes one way. So open boundaries, photon never returns, never reflected, and of course, another way of saying this would be that the photon can actually carry away entropy from the system. Of course, if a big entangled state, but at the end you want to trace over these things that go on very far out here, so in this sense it must be an open quantum system that we consider. So this chirality, this notion of chirality unidirectionally in the openness of the system is something which is intrinsically related to each other. So, as I said before, it sort of gets interesting if you think about these things from the point of view of many-body physics. And this is sort of, again, indicating this photon exchange. This thing goes down and this goes up, as I indicated here before, this broken left-right symmetry. So atoms can only dock to atoms that are sort of further downstream on the right-hand side over here. The usual way in quantum optics how we approach these kind of problems here is this, that you declare your photons over here that are exchanged. And here, of course, in this particular case, these are the photons propagating in this 1D fiber that they have here. By integrating these photons out, and then you get the effective, in this case, it would be a dipole-dipole interaction between these atoms. And what you obtained, of course, in quantum optics always, and this is emphasized, these open boundary conditions over here, is then that you obtain here a master equation. And the master equation always has two parts. I mean, there's a Hamiltonian part that may be sort of renormalized by this integrating out and obtaining then dipole-dipole interactions. And the other one that you have over here would then be some dissipative terms that you have to consider. So you can see that at the end, when you talk about the many-body physics, everything is sort of contained, you know, in these various terms that we have here from the master equation. So this is the familiar situation of these bidirectional master equations, and I've been old referent to some of Derek's papers, but there's actually many references out there that discuss these things. So this would be the standard situation of this symmetric case, and symmetric case sort of has two parts over here. You can see here that we have the dipole-dipole flip-flop interaction that I talked about here before. It's 1D, so it has actually infinite range. And here is the positions, you know, of the two atoms. So this would be dipole-dipole mediated by this 1D reservoir over here, which we integrate out. And then we have a dissipative term down here, which of course is, you know, strongly enhanced. So sort of, you know, it reflects the fact that it is a 1D reservoir that goes out to infinity. So this is sort of this collective spontaneous emission. So this is the familiar situation. And there's a lot of interesting physics here, this kind of Dicke-type master equations. And I mean, Derek is actually the expert for all of these things here. The other extreme now would be the one that corresponds to what these guys out there at the end called the cascading master equation. It's Howard Carmichael and Crispin Gardner that wrote down equations of this type for these unidirectional couplings a long time ago in quantum optics. And you can see that over here, it was actually very important that we had here, we got here spatial dependence. Over here in this unidirectional system, it turns out, so this photon is propagating over here, but if this one is emitted, it never comes back. So there's a time delay between these two systems, but you can sort of always absorb here the time delay of what happens to the second one, because it happens just, you know, at the retarded time of this thing down here. So the first thing that you can see is that this equation over here, again, has the form of a master equation. with the collective decay, because you know if a photon comes out here on the right hand side, you don't know did it come from here or did it come from the first atom. This is the reason why we have a sigma 1 minus and a sigma 2 minus, which is over here. But the asymmetry that this one goes down and the second one up is contained in what we have this, what we call usually the non-Hermitian effective Hamiltonian in these Maxwell equations. The first two terms are very familiar. No, an atom is in the excited state and it can emit and decay a photon. This is radiative damping. This is radiative damping. But you can see that if the first atom goes down, the second one goes up. This is this asymmetric term that I talked about here before. But I really emphasize that it is the whole package of this Maxwell equation together with all of these dissipative terms that makes these things a self-consistent theory. So if you integrate out these photons, this is what you get. And then the question is, you know, do you get interesting physics out, you know, from this kind of an equation, which is, you know, different from the one that we had over here, which was this kind of super radiant. So here there was a symmetry, left-right symmetry, and this symmetry, of course, in this problem is broken. And then the question is, you know, does it lead to interesting results? So it's easy to generalize these things, not only to N atoms, we have done this, but also to a left-right asymmetry, which is broken. This is a gamma L and a gamma R, but I'm not going to write down these equations over here, but sort of want to jump directly now to the interesting physics over here. So in this sense, this is sort of a paradigmatic model that we have now here of these many-body atoms. You can see this chiral, this broken left-right symmetry, photons being exchanged here. We want to add a laser drive to these things, so you know we want to. So there will be many photons emitted by each of these atoms. And as I said, you know, in writing this thing down, we never want here a mirror, so we really want that the entropy is lost here. These photons go out infinity. It's an open quantum system. So that's the triple dissipative quantum many-body system that is somehow interesting and incorporates now this unidirectional kind of interactions that looked so strange at the very beginning. So let me sort of make one a little bit more formal remark over here. So I said before that what we always do in quantum optics is this, that we integrate out our photons here, propagating in these fibers by declaring it to be a quantum reservoir that we treat in this Born Markov approximation. And then we write down here our Maxwell equation. And of course, usually when you integrate a Maxwell equation, so of a driven dissipative system, to infinity, you find that this thing will be in the mixed state. Okay, it will be some density matrix. Think of your optical Bloch equations would be just one example over here. An interesting part now happens. Suppose that you are very lucky, either by, well, maybe by somehow doing quantum engineering, where the steady state that you have over here turns out to be not a mixed state, but actually a pure state. Okay, these are the states that are somehow interesting, and it's even more interesting if the steady state that you obtain by writing down your whole theory means that in a dissipative sense, you prepare not only a pure state, but maybe even some interesting entangled state. And we call states like this that are pure states, we call these things here dark states. And in a many-body system, this would be a many-body dark state. And the question is, you know, whenever we write down Maxwell equations, are we lucky enough that the dynamics over here gives us something which is at the end then by just cooling, you might sort of say, by this dissipative process, all of the entropy is carried away in these input and output boards that we have over here. And the spin system itself sort of cools down to something which is an interesting state. So it's like a kind of a many-body cooling. And this would be your many-body state. And of course, this is now not Hamiltonian physics. This is now sort of Maxwell equation physics that appears over here. So the reason, of course, for telling you these things is that if you take this system here and you make certain special assumptions, like, for example, that the distance between these atoms is something like a wavelength. So this is a commensurate condition, that if I take this system over here and I take my Maxwell equation, integrate out the photons, I find that whatever the initial state is, the system actually in steady state, and I really emphasize that we are putting in continuously energy over here. So this is really Ravi driving that you have over here. The system actually goes in steady state to something which is like a product of these, let me call them quantum dimers. So there are dimers over here. So there's an entangled state between this one and this one, this one and this one, and this one and this one. And it is fundamentally related to the fact that we have this kind of Maxwell equation, this chiral interaction. So if we did not have chirality in the sense of this broken left-right symmetry, this thing would not be true. And if you want to see what they are, I wrote them down over here. It's maybe not so important. We can see that this thing is a pure state, and this is sort of the dimers. You can see that we get here singlet. There's a singlet component, which is turned on if you have a laser. So if you have no laser, both of the atoms are in the ground state, and if you crank up your laser intensity, then you get a singlet component. So this is like an EPR correlation, which is formed. But I really emphasize that this is, you know, for a driven system. So you're constantly putting in energy into the system over here. But nonetheless, the system is driven into this situation. And I'll give you a pictorial explanation for these things now in a minute. So this is an example of getting entanglement from dissipation out. So independent of what the initial state is, you can put in the ground states or any mixed state that you want. The system sort of self-cools down to become then here this entangled state that we have over here. So entropy in this sense is sort of carried away here from this system. This is the essential part. So if you're curious where this thing comes from, I have now a few slides that sort of illustrate what the physics is behind it, and then I show you a little bit of numerics that goes beyond this Paul Markov, and then hand over the microphone to Derek. So look at a system which is sort of the extreme one that let me look at the only cascade it says. So this emits only this direction, which means that this can be absorbed, if this emits, then it goes to the right. So what's the underlying physics here? So this is the one that we have over here. Okay, second photon. So the physics which is going on here is this, that this first atom emits a photon, the second ones emit a photon, but what we will now see in the following is this, that for this magic distance of this lambda that you have over here, these two photons that are emitted in this cascading quantum systems, they interfere out to zero. So if you put the light detector over here, you will find that in the steady state, these two photon wave packets cancel out. And actually, the light goes here dark. This gives this thing as a dark state, sort of a literal meaning. The linear combination of these two things doesn't couple to the light anymore. And so this is destructive quantum interference. And the destructive quantum interference that happens over here only in these cascaded systems is the physical reason for all of these things that are happening here. And here's sort of a more mathematical explanation of this. If I give you two atoms, both in the ground state, excited and state over here, singlet and triplet states that we have here, and the double excited state, you can see the lasers that we're putting in that do these kind of cuppings over here. So in the case that you have cascaded this asymmetric quantum system, it turns out, you know, every quantum optics person, you know, with a good eye can see that we got the lambda system over here. If I give you a lambda system, we got a dark state over here, ground state, and this is exactly a linear superposition of both atoms in the ground state. And it is this singlet excited state over here. So it will be a superposition of these. So in steady state, you drive the system into a linear superposition, and it will be a pure state in the sense of that the system goes into this pure dark state that we have over here. So this is an example of this self-cooling into something which is an entangled state of the system. So if I sort of move on now, it's very clear. No, if I shine in lasers here, this thing goes dark. You know, no light actually comes out over here. We'll see this now happening in a minute when I show you the numerics and show you also this electric field that's propagating here. And then, of course, what happens to the next one? The next one will go dark and so on. So if you do the numerics, you can see that everything goes to a pure state. That's what I was saying. And these are the relative entropies that sort of go down to zero, indicating that each of these pairs that you have over here becomes then, you know, a pure entangled state. So this is now a master equation. At that point, you might ask, I mean, does it depend on how many atoms you have? And the answer, of course, yes, it is, because if you have one single out here, this is a single, then you can see that this one doesn't have a partner. So this means that this one, these two go dark, and this one is unhappy and remains mixed. Okay, so. This is what comes out. So, chiral, and then if you take backscattering into account and they take an odd number of spins, also the whole thing is mixed. So it's sort of an odd even effect that you get over here, and it comes from this chirality that one has. So in this sense, we can sort of summarize what I had here so far. By simply saying, put in any state that you want, your system goes into the product state of these dimers, which is dissipatively prepared, and it only happens if you have chirality. But chirality also implies that you have an open system. And if you're interested in doing these things for more complex situations and ask, why do I get dimers out and not quadrumeres or something like this? And then the answer is, well, if you allow me certain detuning patterns that I put in, I can sort of weave very generally entangled states over here that correspond to some other, you know, rather complex spin structures that one has. So you can make rather, you know, complicated, you know, entangled states over here by just, you know, playing around with certain system parameters that one has here. Let me sort of have a few more slides to show, and want to show them essentially by telling you that these things appear not only in photonic systems, but of course also in phononic systems. But one example that I really like is the one of spin waves, of spins. And the reason is this, that if you write down instead of our photon waveguides, spin waveguides, sort of, you might call it kind of a quantum spintronic. So you got a spin up, which is now sort of propagating to the system. We will see it on the next slide. That we can, in this case, you know, so far we have been integrating out photons. We can easily write down a theory where we keep the waveguide in our dynamics, sort of putting the Markovian cut, where we make this, you know, assumption that the entropy leaves the system at the very end of the system, and then this becomes a very big coupled spin system over here. We can ask ourselves if we can see this going dark and this EPR kind of states that are formed in this context, if you can see them in a much more complete dynamics, which avoids this Markov approximation, at least for the main part of the system. So in this sense, that's interesting because of the physics, but also because we are going here beyond Born Markov, we can use then DMRG kind of ideas to do these things here. This is sort of an indication of what we have in mind in terms of the physics. So suppose that you got a spin over here, and the spin can decay down here, and we got flip-flop dipolar couplings that couple here to the waveguide, which is down here. So for me, the waveguide is sort of now all of these spins on the ground state. Of course, if you have Rydberg atoms, you can do that, and also you can do it with ions if you want to. So what happened is this, that we want this excitation to go down, make a spin excitation over here, and we want the coupling that this thing only moves to the right. And then, of course, what we want is over here, you know, if I did it like this over here, the spin wave would be reflected. That's not what I want. So let's put the Markovian cut over here and include a dissipation that whenever the photon is here, this is like sort of a converter of my spin wave into photon, then it sends it out into whatever. So these spin waves here never return. So the question is, how do we get it? Well, it's actually a very obvious way of getting these things. So if I sort of write down for the spin waveguide that I have down here, my Bloch band, which is indicated down here. What we are asking is this, that if this atom up here decays and makes a spin flip down here, we want it to make a superposition of this one and this one. This is sort of like, you might say, this is like putting in a flux phi over here in such a way that you give these things chirality, that these things only go to one side. This is that you only populate the right moving modes over here. This is what we want. And it's actually easy to achieve just in what I told you here. I just have the left and the right coupling, you know, sigma L and the sigma R over here. And if you add the corresponding phase over here, then it's just that you get this chirality sort of, you know, that kicks the photon always in one direction. So it's easy to engineer and spin chains these kind of interactions here, which physically simply amount to inserting a fictitious flux over here that that writes these phases, you know, when we do our flip-flop processes. So at that point, of course, you can go now and have some fun looking at systems like this. We can write down the master equation here, putting the Markovian cut here, but you keep the complete dynamics here. And you can do now, of course, you know, looking at this, these are edge effects, what you can see over here, but this is essentially sort of recovering exactly what you had in Markovian dynamics. This would be master equation. So it now gets interesting if you now run as a test case with these things where you put two atoms over here and in both of them you got the chiral coupling. This is sort of now a generalization of what we had before. Before we were integrating out the fiber over here, but now we are keeping the dynamics here completely. And now you can see what's happening is this, that we can now again sort of have these magnons or these spin wave excitations over here and look at them here. First of all, in real space, and maybe we should sort of start out here. Notice that we are driving the system continuously up here, so we always put this atom back to the excited state, and it's making more and more photons and more of these kind of hardcore bosons or hardcore photons in our spin model that we have here. So if you start to look at the first part over here, you can see that this is like the electric field which is building up, you know, between these here. Can you see it going dark? This means that we drive the system into a dark state. At the same time, we can also see that the trace of your spin system over here goes to one. This really means that these two atoms that we have over here, they sort of factorize off with their wave function, but at the same time, they become then also a singlet, as you will now see in a minute. And you can also see this is a momentum space over here. Due to chirality, these spin waves are emitted to the right. So you can see darkness. This is chirality over here. It moves to the right, you know what we saw up there. And, okay, that's maybe what I want to show you for the moment. So these are the quantum spin diamond. If you do these things now for n, sorry, this is now going here the other way. It would even in principle be a movie that I have for these things, but I don't want to show it. You can see that this region dark, bright, and every time, you know, you form here this dimer that you have down here. So let me conclude here by simply saying that these are sort of, I find all of these kind of things kind of interesting because this kind of quantum optics is when you do quantum information processing, it's like having input and output with unidirectional flow where you go through these things. So it's like putting together, I mean, as somehow God intended quantum networks to be, you got unidirectional coupling and the whole information flow sort of, you know, goes one way. So in this sense, there would also be a lot of quantum information, you know, protocols to be shown in this context over here. But I just want to show you one stuff as a final slide that would maybe even justify a talk on its own. So we got very intrigued by these systems, you know, with this chirality and whatever they are over here. But you can see that in the second part of my talk, I gave you a prescription how we could go beyond the Born-Markov approximation that where we did not eliminate the reservoir, the fiber that we have over here in the Born-Markov approximation, sort of in perturbation theory. And you can see that this may be important if I take, if you do atoms and they have a very long distance from each other, okay, how do we then do it? Master equations fail. Well, if it's purely cascaded, really one direction, you can always reabsorb it in some retardation, but in principle this fails. And it even more so fails because, you know, this atom over here can put many, many photons into the fiber that propagate over here that the Markov approximation, being a Born approximation, would never describe. There's a very similar system here, which is sort of the most simple one, which would be a two-level atom, you know, that emits photons, and of course the photons go out, but suppose that you put a mirror over here. So this means that this atom will see the stream of photons that's going out here, coming back and driving the atom again with a certain time delay that would correspond to distance to the mirror. So we have developed MPS techniques, matrix product state techniques, that solve the underlying equations by sort of, you know, including here the reservoir and including all of these photon wave packets here. And you can write down a matrix product state describing these things. So this by itself is sort of an interesting MPS application beyond this. And this was work done with Hannes Bichler that came out at the beginning of this year. And it was somehow related work by Kimsmo last year. But I guess that our techniques sort of work also for a very long time to the steady state. So there would be a lot to be said about these things going beyond this Born-Markov, doing quantum optics per se beyond Born-Markov. But with this, I would like to sort of conclude that this is kind of the summary. And I guess now it's your turn, Derek. So should we ask questions at the end then, or?
Maybe even now, right?
Yeah. So let me sort of summarize by saying that I find these things interesting because they are, you know, very unusual interactions. I think that the purpose of this is to confuse every condensed matter theorist by these drawings or sort of pictures of these asymmetrically exchanged photons. I find that usually I confuse people with that, okay? But then the answer is that you have to write down master equations for these things. And what's maybe more interesting than being confusing is the fact that you get some interesting physics out where we have a dissipative formation of these pure quantum dimers or maybe a much more complicated state. So there's really some interesting physics out. And it's relevant. Manuel, of course, is the expert here for these kind of photonic experiments. I want to emphasize one point over here. So why do people at the moment in the experiment not see these things? The reason is, of course, that we make assumptions here. We have here quantum interference. So these atoms, when they emit the photon, we want these photons to go into the fiber. So this is a necessary prerequisite for seeing these kind of effects. If you have a spontaneous emission that incoherently goes out to the back, you destroy this quantum interference that one has over here, and then the whole thing, of course, also disappears. So this is sensitive to quantum interference, and therefore, in this sense, to a perfect system, which is really this one big stuff here. Okay, so are there more questions about this at the moment?
One quick question along those lines. So in terms of this dimer formation because of this interference, if I space my sort of atoms a little bit imperfectly and it's not quite lambda, sort of 1.5 lambda, how much does that change things, or is it still basically dimer?
Okay, so we had a lot of plots about these things, and I guess I don't have them over here. So I would say that if you can make an error of about, say, 10%, then it's typically scaling with the same amount. So it's relatively sensitive to all of these things that violate interference. So whenever you destroy interference, then things go wrong.
And does that scale like extensively? If I have like an n-length dimer chain and I have some sort of imperfection, does the overall imperfection, for example, to
So what it means at the end is this thing that, you're asking how the system goes to the steady state and how this purity sort of propagates. So it's very clear that the first one will be the best one, okay? And so this one hits a little bit, and then tries to disturb this one and so on. So these things sort of get worse as you propagate. What's sort of amusing is this, that if you run time-dependent dynamics on these things and you see how these things settle down, then you sometimes find the quantum trajectory where maybe this one goes dark, but then it leaves out this one here, and these two go dark, but then you can see how they settle down. But then this guy over here, who is not dark, sort of comes in, and then with photon emission sort of starts melting these things again until they finally sort of settle down. Yeah. So we have done characterizations of all of these fidelities of these things, but so sort of what you would expect.
I had a similar question. I'm not sure if I completely understand what you're saying. So if you misspace this a little bit, are you saying that reduced density matrix of all the atoms coupled to the fiber gets mixed, or is it still pure? Is there still a pure dark state if you do that, or?
No, I mean, it will always be mixed. There's a finite fidelity, okay? I mean, that's very clear. The question is, I mean, how much it is mixed, and, I can show you plots.
Can you still get a... I'm just wondering, I mean, this state with the dimers is fine, but it's not a strongly entangled state, right? Because these dimers, they're not coupled to each other. But I'm just wondering if there's a way...
No, but if this thing, if say the distance between this thing, or if you turn on, background emission, then this thing will be in the mixed state, okay? And then the photons that are being emitted out here, they don't interfere completely. There's a little bit left. And this a little bit extra, so the flow will disturb the system over here, okay? And this is... Okay.
Is there a PT symmetry in this problem or no? Because some non-Hermitian Hamiltonians have PT symmetry, and that allows for an extra physics to come in.
Well, in this case, okay, so the proper way of explaining these things is to go back to the original thing. So basically you're asking, I mean, why in the spin orbit coupling of light do you get this asymmetric coupling? Should we discuss this now, or are you explaining this? Or mm-hmm. Okay. So should I explain where it comes from, or? So the physics behind it is the following one, that supposedly you have a waveguide, which is sort of infinite, okay? Normally, if you write down a plane wave, then you would say that you got the light propagation vector, which goes like this, okay? And you got then, of course, a perpendicular polarization vector, like that, okay? But what happens now, if you want to satisfy Gauss law means divergence of the electric field is equal to zero, is this, that if you have strong confinement of your mode, you also develop a forward bending polarization vector, because you got the Gaussian here, and you got something which is propagating to satisfy Gauss law, the polarization vector has to bend forward. And you can see that because this is a Gaussian and this is propagating, these two parts of the polarization vector will be out of phase. Okay, so this means that this has the very peculiar property for these atoms that sit above this fiber that coupled to this mode, that in this space, so they emit light that propagates in this direction with this polarization. Okay, so if I put an atom over here, and I'm driving this atom with sigma plus light, say, okay, and sigma plus light has to come now from the side, okay, so it's not propagating here, it comes from the side. So if I drive my atom, that it emits light, being driven by this, then it emits in this direction. But of course, if you take the atom and you would prepare it with the sigma minus, you would prepare it in the other state, emitting sigma, then it would go the other way. So it's completely symmetric, and the symmetry is sort of broken by the preparation of your atom. Okay, and by the laser that comes from the outside, that's somehow injecting, you know, the or breaking the symmetry, because the laser breaks it there, the slice polarization. Okay?
We have a question. So, in the 70s, there were papers by Lamberg, so like two atoms in vacuum. Mm-hmm. And it was like if you place one atom, there is another. If it is in the near zone, you have radio oscillations, and therefore you have this. So my question is, if you have this chiral medium, like extension, so if you put atom like in the medium zone, and it would start oscillate from here to here, or from here
yes,
to here,
what would be different? You describe is the first master equation that I wrote down, this Dicke master equation, referring to Derek's work, which is exactly the Lamberg master equation written down for the 1D system. It's exactly the physics that you describe, but this is a symmetric one. And we're doing something that Lamberg did not do, because he probably had no motivation for doing that, which is this asymmetry, and this is our discussion.
So my question was, would you observe like asymmetry if you put atoms excited first in the right or in the left?
In the Lamberg master equation?
Or? Yeah.
Of course not, because that's completely, there what you would find is this, that this thing goes down, emits a photon, which is a superposition at left and right, the part that goes to the right, kicks up the other atom, you know, and so absorbs it. But when this thing goes down, again, it can absorb it. So there will be sort of an exchange, but the photon will obviously be lost with a certain probability going out to infinity.
Yes, but if you extend this Lamberg, if you put this chiral medium, in that case, would you see asymmetry?
Basically, this is the old derivation, putting in this asymmetry. Yeah. So there's nothing new in this sense. You know, this is the old physics done in the 1960s. But now we have a reason to make it asymmetric, and we find the interesting many-body physics. So Lamberg was not interested in many-body dynamics. He was writing down these equations to describe super radiance and all of these kind of things. So in terms of this, I would say, you know, if you had thought about 1D systems, and about chirality, he would have written down the same thing, but he had no motivation, I guess. So progress in physics is made by experimental progress that motivates theorists.
One last question. So so you mentioned that it's possible to form interesting sort of tetramer states by looking at different detunings. Is there anything interesting that happens if I just put, for example, n atoms within a single wavelength, but don't do anything special with the detuning?
So you want the distance between these atoms to be smaller than the wavelengths. So in this sense,
if n atoms within a single wavelength, then is there something interesting that actually comes out?
Well, usually we have a lot of reasons not to put atoms so close, or it's because they really. Okay. I don't see anything special happening over here, because this whole system. The reason why these things work is it's infinite range, and it's an effectively one-dimensional system. So you have this, modulo lambda kind of behavior over here, so I don't see anything interesting happen for this small system. So, Eric, what would you say? Be more like a standard. Okay, so you want cascaded, and you want. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never thought about it really. Do you have any reason for?
I guess I was just wondering, in terms of sort of follow up on Menlo's question, of generating sort of maybe interesting building blocks instead of starting with a dimer building block. You said, what can tune detunings in a specific way to get tetramers, but if I just put n, okay, so it might be challenging, but if I just put n within a wavelength, I sort of wonder, is there an effective dark pure state that comes out of that state?
So I have to say that we only found dark pure states for these magic distances, which is the lambda.
Yeah, another question. So this dimer state? In the state itself, is there some phase or something that tells you, or any kind of signature that tells you about which chirality you have, if it's left or right moving? Is it like the dimer doesn't know anymore afterwards? So if I did the same experiment the other way.
There's actually laser phases that are here.
Yeah.
Okay, you can compensate with these laser phases also for these distances here. So there's a relative phase between this laser and this driving, and this gives you the superposition between excited and ground state. So there's a certain phase condition which is in there.
Okay. Does this null about if this is say if this is a right right chirality coupling or left?
If you add one extra.
So what I'm actually what I'm.
If you make it odd, I guess then you know. But I think at least from the dimer state that Peter drew, in terms of this dark state of the lambda system, I don't think it knows.
So it doesn't know anymore about this. That this
if it goes left or right.
Yeah. Does the dimer know if it was right?
So I guess the question.
I mean, I'm not sure I understand the question. I mean, the master equation knows if it's.
The question is: you prepare a state and then forget about everything. Can you restore the information from just the state, which way the light was going? You know, I handle you the state that you prepared, but you don't know which way light was going.
Yes, I say, you don't know what Arno did if it was this way. If it did sigma plus or sigma minus, does the dimer still know?
No, but do all of us agree that the master equation knows what's right and left? Okay, because if I write the master equation for these two, I can, for example, if I trace out this atom over here, this is the standard optical Bloch equation. So this is, you know, this is the single atom equation. You know, so this atom never finds out from its density matrix that there's another atom over here. Okay, because if I trace my master equation, this thing is the standard optical Bloch equation. But if I have this one over here and I trace out the first one, it's not the closed system of equation because the first one drives the second one. Okay? And only both of them together are then driven into the pure state. So this system by itself, the first one, will always be mixed. Will always be mixed. Right?
This is not a question.
No, right.
So the question is if you just look at the dark state itself, just the dimer state, this product state, pure state, and can you, if I just look at the state, would you know if I prepared that state using basically chirality that goes to the right or chirality that goes to the left?
Ah, from left or okay. Well, in a perfect situation, I would say no.
There's nothing.
That's right.
Okay, if you go from even to odd.
If you go from
zero. Right. Then you either have the extra sort of fixed state on the left or on the right.
Yeah, but this was a bit of a question I had actually. So can you maybe have some spontaneous breaking of this chirality if you try for ground state?
Peter,
this was the question actually. Is there a spontaneous breaking of this chirality? Say I would go to odd numbers and drive the system with kind of sigma plus and sigma minus at the same time.
Spontaneous break, I mean, you broke it always by head because, I mean, the gamma right is bigger than the gamma left.
Yeah,
so in this sense.
But I can have, maybe I can drive this. So these atoms are typically some sort of like a.
No, I mean, the difference between the gamma L and the gamma R you put in from the outside
but
by preparing the atoms in an appropriate way.
But I think maybe I can prepare the atoms and there's two states. One that caps with sigma plus, one with sigma minus to this.
Ah, so you want them to compete and start fighting with each other.
Exactly.
Okay.
Maybe
that's actually an interesting idea. Okay.
Spontaneously break. That's why I asked if you can see it.
So you want sort of the two armies that now shoot photons at each other.
And then they end up with one dimerization or the other.
Okay, that's an interesting thought.
So I guess I'd like to just keep the discussion informal. So I have some slides, but feel free to interrupt. So I guess the general theme of this discussion will be one of the kind of last things that Peter mentioned. So why don't you see this dimerization in existing experiments? Or one reason is that in these current experiments, when you couple atoms to the fiber, actually most of the time the atom just emits a photon into free space. Okay, so it doesn't go down the fiber. And this talk, or one of the themes of this talk, is about how to fix that situation with actually just the current experiment you have and not doing something subtle or not having to build some kind of better fiber, which increases the cost. I guess just to cast the problem a little bit more generally, and maybe for those who aren't atomic physics experts, anytime you want to build an atom-light interface, the standard story of how well you can do is if you have a single atom, you can ask, you know, if you focus a beam to the atom, what's the probability that a photon in that beam will scatter off the atom or interact with it? And it turns out if you hit that atom on resonance, it's just a geometric argument. So the scattering probability is going to be inversely proportional to the area of the beam, and then proportional to the scattering cross-section, which actually just turns out to be the resonant wavelength squared. And then the problem is this interaction probability in free space is hard to make close to one because you have to obey the diffraction limit. Okay, so most of the time your area is much larger. And so at least this kind of configuration here, experiments, you might get 5 or 10% efficiency, but not more than that. And so the typical ways that you fix it, I guess there's kind of two. So one is instead of just having the photon hit the atom a single time, you put two very good mirrors around the atom and build a high finesse cavity. In that case, that scattering probability is enhanced by the number of bounces. And if you're familiar with cavity QD language or James Cummings model, you can take the same quantity and rewrite it as G squared over kappa gamma in the James Cummings language, or that's also known as the cavity properativity. The other thing you can do is to use many atoms. In that case, the interaction probability is just enhanced by the number of atoms. And in kind of atomic physics language, that's nothing more than the optical depth of the system. So these kind of numbers, cooperativity or optical depth, they're kind of widely viewed as the fundamental limit for anything you want to do with atoms and light. So you can just find hundreds of papers where people analyze it and see that that's true. So here's a kind of cavity QED experiment from Rempe's group where they try to build a kind of quantum gate between an atom and photon. And they say in principle the gate mechanism works perfectly, except in practice we have a finite cooperativity. You can try to do some kind of nonlinear gate. Again, it works as well as the cooperativity of the system. And then in kind of atomic ensembles, one of the things you might want to do is build some kind of quantum memory. So you send in a photon and try to coherently convert it to a spin flip. And then Alexei Gorshkov actually has a really nice analysis where he says kind of no matter what you do, no matter what kind of scheme you choose, when you optimize it, how well you do depends only on the optical depth of the medium. So the error is actually something like 1/1 optical depth. So I guess the question is there a loophole to that? So in practice, the problem, let's say for atomic ensembles, is your optical depth, at least in these kind of experiments, is going to be 100 or less. And once you put in the prefactors, that means your kind of storage probability is going to be 90%. So what's the potential loophole? So here's the kind of argument again. And roughly why the scaling occurs is you kind of say, well, each atom has a probability of talking to the good mode, in this case, the Gaussian beam, versus the bad, which is scattering into free space. And then the effectiveness of this interaction is just multiplied by the number of attempts. So it's kind of an independent picture. If one atom fails, the next one has a chance to succeed. And then there's the important assumption in there is the coupling to free space is assumed to be independent, right? So each atom is trying and failing on its own. But that can't be true, right? Because we know that atoms emit as waves. So this emission into other directions can actually interfere. And so the question is, what if we try to maximally take advantage of that? Can we do better than these kind of naive scaling limits? And so in some language, this is also related to the physics of super and subradiance. So subradiance is the idea that you can have an atom excited as a kind of collective excitation in an ensemble, and that excitation is going to decay much more slowly than a single atom, a single excited atom would on its own. So subradiance is a kind of really intriguing phenomenon, right? That you can just create excitations and it hangs around in there forever without any dissipation. And then one of the kind of tricks, I think one of the reasons that people haven't really explored using subradiance before is that it's hard to, historically people haven't really understood where subradiance comes from, what's the physical origin. So I'd like to try and explain, at least in some set of systems, where subradiance comes from, that there's a nice kind of physical interpretation, and that in turn gives you a way to use it. So the question is, can you basically use collective emission to enhance atom-light interfaces? The answer seems to be yes. And I guess there's kind of three parts of this answer, three things you need to do to answer this question. So the first thing you need to do is just come up with some formalism that allows you to treat atom-light interactions that include this kind of subradiance or this collective emission. So a lot of times in your analysis, like in the James Cummings or in atomic ensembles, you just build in from the beginning into your toy model that every atom emits independently into free space. So if you build that into your model from the beginning, of course, you're going to get cooperativity or optical depth out as the limit in the end. So we want to come up with a model that doesn't assume coupling to independent bats. The next thing is you can understand subradiance. It turns out a really nice kind of interpretation of subradiance comes when you put atoms in ordered arrays. In a 1D chain, it turns out subradiance is nothing more than guided modes of that chain. So this atomic chain is nothing more than like a fancy optical fiber. And then the next thing to introduce is, well, subradiance on its own doesn't really help you to improve atom-light interfaces, because subradiance almost by definition means the atoms don't talk to any modes, optical modes of the outside world. So the next concept you can think about is something like selective subradiance. So can you create some kind of situation where the atoms collectively emit only into the modes that you want and not into the modes that you don't want? And you can do that by coupling atoms, for example, to an optical nanofiber. So this kind of formalism that allows you to treat subradiance in general settings, the kind of workhorse here is the classical electromagnetic Green's function. So the formal definition is, well, the Green's function is just a solution to the electromagnetic wave equation, given some permittivity in the frequency domain, and for a delta function source. So what G physically describes is, you know, you put a kind of oscillating classical dipole at R prime that's going to start radiating a dipole field. You're allowed to have some kind of dielectric materials nearby. And then G of R basically tells you what's the total field at this position. So it can be the free field emitted by the dipole, plus any kind of rescattered fields. So technically, G is a tensor quantity. Alpha and beta can be X, Y, and Z. And that's because your dipole here can be oriented in three directions. And then the field at position R is a vector quantity. So in what I'm going to talk about here, the tensor nature is not going to be particularly important, but that's just the formal definition. And again, in free space, the Green's function is nothing more than the radiation pattern of a oscillating dipole. So it's this kind of famous formula that you can look up in any electromagnetics textbook. So in particular, in the far field, it goes like 1 over R. So this kind of formalism, the first thing you want to do is kind of strange. So a priori, you're interested in some kind of atom-light interaction problem, like how light interacts with and propagates through an array of atoms. And it turns out the best way to solve it, at least for this kind of particular purposes here, is to get rid of the light from the very beginning. And the reason that it's kind of nice is, you know, especially when you're talking about the quantum regime, when you're talking about propagating fields, there's an infinite Hilbert space associated with that continuum. And so getting rid of the light, integrating it out from the beginning, helps them map the problem to a discrete Hilbert space of just the atomic degrees of freedom. So to kind of illustrate that it's possible, I'll just kind of give a classical analogy. So imagine you have some kind of input beam, which you know. It could be a Gaussian beam, for example. And then you have some classical point dipoles, some polarizable objects. And it's fair to assume, I think, that you know the polarizability of these dipoles. And then the question is, when you shine this light in and it interacts with these dipoles, what's the total field at some other point? So we know the radiation pattern for a dipole. So kind of intuitively in the classical regime, the electric field at this point is going to be what you send in, plus that which is re-radiated by all the other dipoles. So the radiation at this point due to this dipole here is just going to be the amplitude of that dipole times the Green's function, which basically propagates the dipole out to your detection point. So that kind of makes sense at a kind of classical level. But I guess the point is, at a quantum mechanical level, your electric field becomes operator, and your dipole becomes an operator. But the way that light propagates is still the same. Okay, so both quantum fields and classical fields obey the same Maxwell's equations. So you can put hats on all these kind of quantities. But then the quantity here, which describes propagation, is still the classical electromagnetic Green's function. So this is formally true, but not exactly helpful yet, because this is in the frequency domain. So if I try to write it in the time domain, I have the problem that, you know, the Green's function, in principle, depends on the frequency of light. And then this kind of product here becomes a convolution in the time domain. And then here's just a special case where having atoms is really nice. So atoms are very high Q elements. So their emission line width is just a few megahertz compared to their central frequency, which is hundreds of terahertz. So what that means basically is atoms are very dispersive. Over very small frequency differences, their response changes completely. So what that means is in the frequency dependence here, you need to treat this degree of freedom seriously. But then the Green's function, so how light propagates, you know, when you just change the frequency by a few megahertz, over the distances that are relevant for atoms, that change is usually negligible. So you don't have to really use the frequency dependence here of the Green's function. You can just stick in some central frequency, like that of the atoms.
So is this the same as doing the Markov approximation?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so in this kind of formulation, you don't have to make the Born approximation. So you get the same answer if you do Born Markov. But here you don't have to assume the Born approximation, but I think this is equivalent to Markov.
Well, but the Born sort of comes in if you repeat these things back and you want to derive an equation for your sigmas.
Uh-huh, right.
Okay,
So I'll do that in the next slide. So once you ignore this kind of frequency dependence of the Green's function, you get left with a generalized input-output equation in time for the atoms. And qualitatively, this equation is really nice because it says what you get out as an operator field is what you send in, plus that which is rescattered by the atoms. So really, all the independent degrees of freedom are encoded in just the atoms themselves.
So why are you ignoring time delays here? I mean, in principle, there's a retardation.
Yeah, so I guess the idea is, as one example, let's say you have an atomic gas, right, just two-level gas. So when you send in light, you get much more dispersion from the atoms than from free space. In other words, the speed of light does not really dictate the refractive index of the atomic gas near resonance. It's all dictated by the atomic dispersion. That's maybe another way to interpret this.
So if I take my position very far away, there will be a time delay.
Oh yeah, so this right, exactly. Okay. So in free space, this equation would break down if the two atoms are separated by more than the length of a spontaneously emitted photon. But that's like kind of meters. The easier way to break it down in practice is if you can always construct some dielectric from my environment with a very sharp frequency response. So another regime where this thing breaks down is cavity QED in the strong coupling regime. So what you can do is now we have an equation for the field that depends completely on the atoms. And now we can stick that into the evolution equation for the atoms. And so qualitatively, what you get is you get an equation of evolution for the atoms that only depends on other atoms alone. So you can the resulting equations that you can derive it all from effective Hamiltonian. Which again is just going to contain the Green's function. Okay, so there's two parts of this Hamiltonian. The first is the type of interaction you get is if you have two-level atoms, this term here says that one atom can be in the excited state. It can drop down to the ground state. Another atom which is in the ground state will jump up to the excited state, of course all mediated by photon exchange. And that's why the kind of interaction strength out here is proportional to the Green's function. Okay? It describes the amplitude of that propagation. So one thing that's important is that this is a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian. It's a kind of a shorthand form. If you want, you can write it more properly as a kind of full master equation. And it's non-Hermitian because this describes not only the possibility of coherent exchange, but of spontaneous emission as well. And the important thing is, this is all collective. So this kind of Hamiltonian here describes not just, doesn't assume single atom spontaneous emission, but really captures the possibility of collective emission or the physics of subradiance. So just to see that this kind of equation works, it has to work for a single atom as well. So if we just take a single atom, then I don't have off-diagonal elements I and j. So Eg times Ge is just the excited state population. And then the Green's function is just the Green's function of a point dipole at its own location. So you can calculate or look up what that is. It's just I times omega over 6 pi c. And then when you multiply all this together, you indeed get a single atom spontaneous emission rate in free space. Okay, so it works in kind of limits that, kind of trivial limits that you expect. So as I mentioned before, there are some limits of ability, so you can't have strong coupling effects like in cabinet QED. It ignores time retardation, which in free space means you can't have your atoms sitting 10 meters apart. But aside from that, one nice thing about this formalism is it equally captures any system of light interacting with atoms. So it could be atoms in free space, atoms in a cavity, apart from strong coupling, atoms coupled to a nanofiber. All you have to do is compute what this Green's function is for a particular dielectric geometry. So now let's apply this for atoms in free space. So again, here's the kind of spin model in general. And again,
could just ask you, so I mean the equation that you wrote down so far is exactly the Lemberg Master equation, which is sort of proof for that purpose.
So in free space, I mean this has been written down in a lot of different settings before. Maybe people didn't call it Green's function. I think the more subtle thing is that this equation works in dielectric settings as well, even if they're dispersive and absorbing. So to get that, you really have to start from some quantized theory of light in dispersive and absorbing geometries. And you do it and you get the same answer. So maybe you could have guessed it, but to formally show that that's true didn't come around until the past 10 years because of the difficulty of quantizing light in dispersive and absorbing media. So this is generally true. So we're going to take a Green's function that's just the free space dipole radiation pattern. And we still have to specify some geometry. And the one I'm going to specify is just a one-dimensional chain of atoms, but again, living in three-dimensional space. So n atoms in a row separated by a lattice constant, d. So the first thing you can consider is just one excitation. Okay. So since this is a kind of number-conserving Hamiltonian, there's just n possible states that matter. So the first atom could be excited, the second atom, the third, and so on. And so in this one excitation subspace, this Hamiltonian just becomes an n by n matrix that you can go and diagonalize. So the first thing you can try is to just do it numerically. So you diagonalize this thing, you get n eigenvalues. The eigenvalues have some real part, which corresponds to some kind of energy shift. So these collective excitations might have a resonance energy that's different than that of a single atom that's isolated. And then you get an imaginary term as well, which describes the emission rate of that collective state. So here's just a kind of typical illustration of what happens. So let's take 30 atoms in a row. This part is a little bit complicated, but let me try and explain the axes. So what I'm going to consider first is if I have 30 atoms, I have 30 eigenvalues, and each one of them is going to have some resonance energy. So on the horizontal axis, it's going to be the lattice constant. So if I just fix it as some value, let's say 2.1, there's actually going to be 30 points along this vertical axis. And those 30 points denote the 30 energy shifts in units of the single atom emission rate. So when you're out at large distances, like several wavelengths, there are technically 30 eigenvalues, but they're all pretty close to zero. Okay, so atoms that are very far apart basically act like independent atoms. And then you can do the same thing for the imaginary part of the eigenvalue, which basically describes the decay rate. And again, when atoms are very far apart, all these 30 decay rates, collective decay rates, are pretty close to the single atom isolated emission rate. So at large distances, these dipole-dipole interactions don't matter. As you bring the atoms closer together, so as the lattice constant gets smaller, you get more and more variation. At lambda over 2, you get even more variation. But then once you get below lambda over 2, you see a really kind of qualitative change in the behavior. Okay, so there's a number of collective excitations whose decay rate goes almost to zero. And you can ask, what does almost to zero mean? So you can plot it on a log scale and analyze it a little bit more. What you find is that the decay rate scales decreases asymptotically like the number of atoms in the chain to the third power. And then if you just index these states by in order of the most subradiant to second and third, so m is 1, 2, 3, then the coefficient in front goes like m squared. So what this says is really this kind of interference of wave emission really matters at close distances, so when atoms are less than lambda over 2 in a 1D chain. So you can ask why that is. And then one thing you can do to get some complementary intuition is you can consider just the case of an infinite chain. Okay, so in that case, the eigenstates are just going to be block modes. So a general single particle state is going to be one where atom J is excited with some relative phase e to the ikc. Okay. So you can analyze the spectrum in this kind of block wave vector space. And so let me try to just qualitatively argue what the kind of band structure should look like. Okay. So K now is going to be my block wave vector. In the first free Von zone, it's going to extend out to pi over the lattice constant. And one important quantity, if I'm looking at first the real part of the eigenvalue, it's good just to plot the single atom resonance frequency for reference. So one thing you can say, I haven't said anything here about polarization or level structure, but one thing you can say that's kind of pretty generic is because atoms are very high Q elements, the bands that atoms can support is going to be relatively flat. Okay, so you know, I don't know what the specific shape is, but the line width is going to be comparable to the single atom line width. Okay, so actually on this scale, it would be completely flat. So another thing that's important to plot is just what's the dispersion relation of light in free space. That's omega equals ck. That's this green dotted line here. So far we're talking about the spins, but remember that from this input-output equation, I can always, given some spin excitation, I can always reconstruct what the electric field is everywhere in space. And the point is, if my spin wave has a given k vector, then the electric field also has to have the same wave vector, because everything satisfies Bloch's theorem. And the thing is that this k vector only represents the k vector along the direction of the chain. Okay, so in this case, z. But my total electric field has a kind of on-axis wave vector, but a transverse wave vector as well, k perpendicular. Okay, so this is a kind of plane wave decomposition of the fields. And in free space, these k vectors can't be arbitrary. They have to satisfy the free space dispersion relation, which is k squared plus k perpendicular squared equals omega over c squared. And so if k itself is bigger than omega over c, that implies that k perpendicular is imaginary, or that the electric field is evanescent. Okay, so it decays exponentially as you go away from the chain. That means it can't radiate energy. And so what it means is this kind of light line here separates two kinds of spin waves with very different character. So outside of this light line in this region here, the k vector along this direction of propagation is too big. It forces the electric field associated with the spin wave to be evanescent, so it can't radiate energy out to infinity. That means that if you look at the imaginary part of these eigenvalues, it forces that to be zero. And then the k vectors in this region, they're allowed to radiate. Okay. So what this says is, an infinite chain of atoms supports guided modes just like an optical fiber would. Okay, so there's a set of k vectors that are too big, and it just forms some kind of evanescent field around the atomic chain. For that to be true, based on this kind of cartoon drawing here, the only condition where that I need to satisfy is that this light line has to intersect the edge of the Brillouin zone above the atomic resonance frequency. So you can take that condition and rewrite it in terms of distances, and it turns out that's exactly equivalent to the lattice constant being smaller than lambda over 2. And then, so that's the case for an infinite chain. You find that there are states with exactly zero decay rate, which are just guided modes of the chain. And then for a finite chain, you can just interpret that as, a fiber that you cut. Okay, so a fiber guides light perfectly until you cut the ends, and then radiates light off the ends. And again, you can apply the input-output relation to calculate what the fields look like for a finite-sized chain. And indeed, it looks like a fiber that's just cut off. Okay, so all the energy is being radiated off the ends of that atomic chain. So far I was talking about single excitation physics, and that's classical. So if I replace all this with classical dipoles, I would get the same story. But for atoms, you might ask, what do multiple excitations look like? So it might be nice to encode many body physics into these subradiant states. Let's give an example. I know my single particle excitations, and I can assign S1 dagger as a collective spin creation operator for the most subradiant single particle state. Okay, so that has some kind of amplitudes Cj. And then I can ask just a simple example, what if I try to create two excitations? So maybe the most natural one to try creating is S dagger square. Okay, so I'm going to put two of these spin waves on top of each other. And then you can ask, is it an eigenstate, and is it a subradiant one? So if it's bosonic, then the answer is yes. It's a kind of non-interacting boson story. So then this state here would just have a decay rate that's twice that of a single particle. But it turns out that because it's spin, the answer is no, and it's not even close. So the intuition is the following. So let's take this S1 dagger square, and let's just write out the wave function. So I can have any two atoms, I and j, excited, and Cij is going to be the amplitude of that for that pair to be excited. So I can plot this Cij squared versus I and j, and it's going to be overall relatively smooth because the single atom, single excitation spin wave itself is smooth, except down the middle, right? Because I can't excite this same spin twice. And remember that the notion of subradians is tied to guided modes. I have k vectors that sit beyond some critical value, so they can't emit into free space anymore. And the issue is if I create any kind of wave function with a very sharp kink, when I Fourier transform that wave function, it's going to have k vectors everywhere. Okay, so the fact that you have spin here implies that this kind of two excitation state is not going to be subradiant anymore, or very weakly subradiant. It's not an eigenstate, but if you calculate the expectation value for its decay rate, it's not a 1 over n cubed anymore. It's increased to be 1 over n. So then the kind of natural question is, how do you construct many-body or subradiant states? So again, what we have at our disposal is we know the single particle eigenstates. And then we know that the subradiant states from this intuition should satisfy two properties. So the first is they should be composed of wave vectors beyond the light line. So that's almost that's basically guaranteed from these kind of single particle subradiant states. But they should also be spatially non-overlapping. That's what avoids these kind of sharp kinks in my many-body wave function. So based on that kind of intuition, the one thing you might try is to create some kind of fermionized wave function. So try to construct states from these single particle states that have Pauli exclusion built in. So these particles kind of smoothly repel each other. So for example, for two excitations, I can take my two darkest single excitation states, m equals 1 and m equals 2. And then the two excitation state I create would be Ci1, Cj2. Minus Ci2, Cj1. So it's a kind of Slater determinant or built-in Pauli exclusion. So here's what that kind of two excitation wave function looks like. And indeed, it turns out that these states are very good ansatz for the exact solution. So these are very close to the darkest two particle states, two excitation states that you can create. And the nice thing is that you preserve this kind of 1 over n cubed scaling for the decay rate. And you can generalize this to the many-body limit if you believe in this ansatz. So if I have n atoms and m excitations, I can create states whose decay rate is as low as basically 1 over, that scales as the density of excitations cubed. So maybe I'll try to just go for a couple more minutes. So now we kind of understand where subradiance comes from, both for single excitations and multiple excitations. But then to use it, we have this problem that, you know, subradiant states just by definition, you know, very weakly couple to outside optical modes. So in particular, you know, if I have this kind of chain of atoms, if I come in with a free space laser, this is a propagating field, which means that the laser lives inside the light cone. Okay, so just by kind of impedance mismatch or momentum mismatch, I can't talk to these subradiant states. So the way you fix that is with an optical nanofiber. So the idea is the nanofiber itself has guided modes whose k vectors live beyond the light line. And so those modes should be able to talk to these high k vector modes of the atoms just fine. In that case, what happens is that these modes will hybridize. Okay, so they're not subradiant anymore. Now these atomic excitations can emit into the fiber just fine. But in terms of enhancing atom-light interfaces, that's exactly what you want. Right, you want that your atoms talk perfectly to some easy mode to address, in this case the guided mode of the fiber, and not be able to emit into the outside world. Okay, so this is like the perfect situation. Maybe I'll just kind of summarize. So one thing we've analyzed, for example, is, you know, if you really account for this collective emission, how well can you do things like photon storage or quantum memory? So in the independent emission model, if you just assume each atom couples to its own bath, then so a single atom would have a decay rate gamma 1d to emit into the guided modes of the fiber. When you have many of them, you can get a collective emission rate n times gamma 1d. That's kind of well known. But then if you assume independent emission in a free space, then your error is just gamma prime over n gamma 1d. So 1 over number of atoms or 1 over optical depth. So it turns out when you analyze it, including this kind of collective emission, you can actually do exponentially better. Okay, so let me kind of show you what the answer, you know, what people would have said the answer is a year ago. So if you assume this independent emission model, the error goes like 1 over n. So if you take kind of normal numbers for a nanofiber, if you have 200 atoms, your EIT, your photon storage rate, would have an error of, you know, 10 to 20%. Okay. But when you do the honest calculation, if I can put these 200 atoms in a row in a kind of ordered lattice, and I play some kind of tricks to optimize, the error turns to exponential. Okay. So the same number of atoms with the same fiber gives you an error rate that's just so small that it's not even, you know, it's just kind of academic argument. You're just, you know, limited then by kind of technical constraints. Just to kind of summarize, I think this kind of idea of exploiting collective effects and spontaneous emission, you know, really has a lot of potential for atoms. We know for proton storage, you can do exponentially better than what people thought. But, you know, there's many things that people want to do with atoms, you know, nonlinear optics, photon gates, spin physics, lattice clocks. I think it'd be really interesting to re-explore all these kind of phenomena, building in subradiance. And then I guess the second thing, maybe more generally, is you know, all these calculations were based on this kind of quantum spin model. Okay, so I'm trying to solve some kind of atom-light interaction problem, but I treat it first as a quantum spin model. I try to solve the spins and their correlation functions, and from there I try to reconstruct the fields. So I guess the question is, you know, what if we really try to take that seriously? You know, that says that all of quantum optics with atoms is just an open quantum spin model, and I can solve quantum optics as well as I can solve an open quantum spin model. So how far that takes you, I don't know, but I think it's a kind of fascinating question to think about.
I have a question. So then you have this wire. It reminds me a bit of surface polaritons. Uh-huh. And I think Agronovich already in the 60s considered 1D systems. And he noticed that in that case you have this matching of K only in one direction and another you don't have. And I do not recall whether he considered surface modes. Mm-hmm. But for 2D, for sure, even there is a book in the 80s which is called Surface Polaritons, mm-hmm. Agronovich and Maradudin.
Right. Yeah, it's very similar physics. I think the key is to connect that concept of guided modes or surface modes to the notion of subradiance and also normalize that by what you normally know about atoms, so, you know, concepts like optical depth.
So to study many body physics, you potentially need, right, some extensive number of excitations. At least
right.
If you want finite energy density, is that in an achievable range? Or again, like, what would you have to do to choose this number of excitations to be extensive?
Oh, well, I guess that depends. That depends very much on the specific system you or setup you want to consider. I mean, so it's easy to excite atoms.
Yeah,
just
hard, but I'm not sure if this is the right thing. It's just explainable.
Right.
Put in a sequence, sequence.
Right. I guess the non-trivial thing is you see that you can have many excitations and still have the system be subradiant, but they should kind of physically repel each other. So I think that's the question. For example, you can ask, can I build a lattice clock and have beat the standard quantum limit for a clock? I don't know what the answer is, but probably if you were going to do it with this subradiance, you would want to not excite all the atoms with a pi over 2 pulse, which is what you'd normally do for lattice clocks, you know, normal Ramsey spectroscopy. You would want to find some way to kind of do pi over 2 pulses in for atoms in blocks to preserve that subradiance.
So in the model that you had here, all of the atoms were frozen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but remember that in some of your papers, you also looked at motion. Is there concern that when the atoms sort of move too close, that these light-induced collisions will do a lot of damage and make sort of the model, the two-level model that one writes down here, wrong at one point?
Yeah, so it's something that we want to analyze more carefully. So if atoms are really moving around, I think that's not good for this subradiance, because what it does is it changes how well you can couple to that state.
An example would be the quantum gas microscope, where we know that if you put two atoms in there and you excite them, I mean, you lose them actually pairwise immediately.
Yeah, so you
have to keep them separate here. Okay.
Yeah, so ideally you want to just have atoms very tightly trapped in their own individual lattice sites, so they can't really explore or collide with their neighbors. To turn that into a quantitative statement, I have a guess of how it scales, but I'm not sure yet.
What kind of interesting stuff can I do with Nocta? Not all the tools kind of
hard.
There's some tricks you can play, but
Okay, so in 1D, the condition for subradiance is lambda over 2. That's a sufficient condition. In 2D and 3D, it becomes lambda over square root of 2 and lambda over square root of 3, because it has to do with how your Brillouin zone looks in higher dimensions. Given that, for a 2D case, so if you have a 2D sheet, there's actually a hidden point within the light cone that still is subradiant. So the notion is, if you're inside the light cone, you expect that state to couple to light, but it's not a necessary condition. So it turns out in 2D, there's a certain kind of polarization of the transition that's still subradiating out to lambda. I don't know what happens that's interesting that's kind of beyond lambda. But
I would still see some effect of that, right? I mean, you had all these tips, so this would be super radiant.
So
if I would really hit it at lambda exactly, I could see kind of strong.
Yeah, so for sure, even if you're not at lambda, you would see corrections to the kind of independent atom model. So that in itself could be interesting to explore. But if you want these kind of, you know, very different decay rates to kick in, as far as I know, as far as I can see, you need to get below lambda.
Yeah, I think somehow you need to track into that stuff. It's very difficult. It's actually something in Schunzen, which I literature says you could track this 5 something, and then there's actually a 3 micrometer transition.
Uh-huh.
So it would be perfect. So it would be lambda over 6.
Right.
Question. This is the stop.
Okay.